Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. And now what it really takes to defeat terrorism. It's a question that members of Congress must consider as they hear testimony today from Defense Secretary James Mattis on authorizations for the use of force. The last time Congress authorized the use of force, it was in the wake of the September 11th attacks, but it has been used to deploy American troops against terrorist groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda in places like Syria and Niger. How effective are military tactics against terrorists? Are we in an era where it may be impossible to defeat the threat of terrorism? Foreign affairs journalist Robin Wright has been covering terrorism since she was living in Beirut in 1983 when Hezbollah pulled off its first suicide bombing against the American embassy. She's written about it in an article for The New Yorker titled 16 Years After 9/11, How Does Terrorism End? And as she joins us, I'd like you to consider this. Do you think Americans have moved beyond the never again frame of mind about terrorism on our soil? That we're more prepared and more practical about the idea of it. That's something to consider as Robin joins us. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Robin is a joint fellow at U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center, and she's a contributing writer at The New Yorker. She's with us from D.C. Robin, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
It's always great to be with you.
I'm interested in your view of this idea of the 9/11 authorization of force and whether it applies to the kinds of counterterrorist operations that the military has been involved in. Have you been thinking about that?
Not really. I cover foreign wars, foreign militant groups, and not the legalisms of how you go to war, but it is clear that it's an issue that's been brewing for some time to try to figure out how presidents are authorized to take military action against groups. We are in a period where the nature of warfare has changed dramatically. It's hard to believe, but the United States has only fought one conventional war since the end of the Korean War in 1953, and I think most Americans might have a hard time remembering which one that was. Most of them are unconventional. Most of them involve non-state actors. Most of them don't have front lines, that it's much murkier than that, and that reflects the kind of conflict we've seen in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's the wave of the future.
You know, it's the wave of the future. I think that's important to follow up on, especially when we consider what you've said about war no longer fits this historical frame that we put around it. So why do you believe that it's the wars of the future?
Well, increasingly you find that with the major powers, they either have arms agreements or are unlikely to go to war with each other. They're more likely to go to war through surrogates. But the real challenges to when we look at our history in this century is we fought, whether it was an insurgency, underground insurgency in Iraq, and then the emergence of an extremist group in Afghanistan. We fought the Taliban, again, a group that was not on a particular front line. It was, they would, you know, roadside bombs and suicide bombers. And the tactics are very different than during the First and Second World Wars, for example, when you had front lines and you literally took back, whether it was inch by inch or foot by foot, territory until you defeated the enemy, and that both sides had conventional weapons that they used against each other, tanks, artillery, and gunfire. Today, it's a very different kind of conflict. That is, the enemy would be outmanned, outgunned, perhaps, but often can be just as effective.
Yeah. Question for you just about that from Cole in St. Paul. Hi, Cole. What do you want to know from Robin?
Hi. So I've been a student of social history for a while now, and this idea of how to defeat enemies that use non-traditional tactics is a recurring one since the Vietnam War and beforehand. What I'm wondering is, when we talk about this idea of defeating or solving terrorism, What I think gets left out, what I find gets left out of most of the conversations I hear, is the definition of what we're talking about. For instance, when we talk about defeating terrorism, the first thing that comes to mind is you're trying to defeat an idea. And I think that's obviously impossible. And then when we expand the scope to white Christian terrorism in the States, which you can get recognized as that, or we talk about insurgencies that are being fought by national forces or eco-terrorism. Or
Cole, I have to interrupt here because we're getting a little bit off the essence of what we're talking about. But Robin, I think you've got the core of what he was asking about. How do we define the scope of terrorism?
Well, it's a very important question, and he's absolutely right. We often find ourselves fighting ideas, and I think that's been reflected in the war against ISIS. We have now witnessed the demise of the caliphate, but ISIS is still an organization with fighters committed to a cause, committed to an idea of creating another caliphate down the road. But it really comes in the middle of this political transition in the Middle East, where there is an enormous vacuum of ideas, ideology, leadership, people or systems providing a sense of the future, a sense of security, a sense of economic hope and jobs, that for many, ISIS was one of the few groups out there offering something. Even though we think it's abhorrent, it was for some, because of the sectarian divide in the region, looked at initially anyway as a way to represent their interests. There was a growing disillusionment because of its tactics. In the end, it survived 3 years, 3 months, and 3 weeks. But you know, again, the idea is still out there, and that's the hardest part. I think one of the things we've learned during this war, and we learned it in earlier conflicts too, unfortunately, is that we can militarily defeat, whether it's ISIS or the Taliban in Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but that we still have the big question of what is the alternative. And the United States has struggled repeatedly to figure out alternatives that are embraced politically, seen as legitimate locally, and having answers that really do fill the gap, fill the vacuum. And that's the struggle. Now, I have some interesting statistics that I think are really helpful to people to understand what happens with terrorism. Mm-hmm. And there was a study done of 450 different terrorist groups that have emerged since the current wave began in 1968. And that's not just the Middle East, that's globally. And what's really interesting is that the average lifespan of a group is 8 years. And that gives you some sense of hope that they do die out. Mm-hmm. The very first group that engaged in a terrorist attack was actually a anti-Castro group, and it mailed a bomb from New York to Havana, where it was opened and injured 5 people. That group survived only a year, less than a year. That only 5% of terrorist groups actually succeed or achieve their goals, and some of them have been embraced in the end by the international community. When you look at, and this will surprise some of your listeners, when you look at how Nelson Mandela became famous, he formed the armed wing of the African National Congress in South Africa. And that armed wing's first act of violence against the apartheid government was 5 bombings simultaneously, same day, in 3 different South African cities. You look at, and of course, Nelson Mandela went on to become the democratically elected president after the end of apartheid and won the Nobel Peace Prize. The same thing with the Irgun in Israel during the days before it was created. And Menachem Begin was involved leading the group when it bombed the King David Hotel, killing 91 people. These are groups that, and he went on to become prime minister and also win a Nobel Peace Prize for making peace with Egypt, that when the aspirations are limited or in terms of getting a piece of property, changing the political system, that they are more attainable. The ones that are utopian inevitably fail. And so there's a kind of lesson there.
Robin, I wonder where you put Hezbollah in the description that you've just given, because your New Yorker piece has this really vivid description about that 1983 embassy bombing in Beirut. You were there. You saw the aftermath of it.
There were three bombings in Beirut in 1983 and 1984 that define the current wave of terrorism for the United States and the challenges we face in the Middle East. The first one was at an embassy, which was just down the street from my office, went off at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a huge explosion that set off a mushroom cloud over all of West Beirut. The second one was in October that year, and that awakened me. It was on a balmy October morning, and about 6:30 in the morning, and I don't know anyone who wasn't awakened by the sound of that explosion. It was the largest non-nuclear explosion anywhere on Earth since World War II, and it killed 241 Marine peacekeepers who were there dispatched by the Reagan administration after the Israeli intervention in Lebanon, and the largest loss of U.S. military life in a single incident since Iwo Jima, still true to this day. And then a year later, there was a second embassy that was attacked. And this was the beginning of Hezbollah, the attacks against the Americans to try to get them to leave Lebanon, to not be the ones who are dictating what was happening in the midst of a civil war in Lebanon, who should win and who should lose. And what's interesting is how Hezbollah has evolved. And this is really critical to understanding terrorism, too, that a decade after it was born and survived in the underground through violent attacks, a new leader decided that it was going to become a mainstream political party, and it began running for parliament in the early 1990s. It today has not only cabinet positions, members of parliament, but the president of Lebanon is a longstanding ally of Hezbollah. Hezbollah today is the second largest employer in Lebanon after the Lebanese government.
Oh, wow.
And it offers something besides kind of a militia arm, and therefore has built local political legitimacy. And those are the groups that are really hard to challenge.
Question for you here from Ethan in Owatonna. Hi, Ethan. What's your question?
Hey, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I honestly think that if there was going to be a real effort to diminish religious extremists or terrorists in any given country or nation, that education would be paramount. Like, you wouldn't need a military action so much as you would need more of a humanitarian one. And I think that education could prevent not only current, but maybe future terrorists as well.
I totally agree with you. And I think one of the problems is going to be galvanizing American resources to do just that. The United States has been spending on average $13 million a day to bomb various ISIS targets in both Iraq and Syria. And we have given on the humanitarian front as well. But there's a famous scene in Charlie Wilson's War at the very end that addresses your very point. Here is this Texas congressman, true story, who mobilized tens of billions of dollars to help fund and arm the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet intervention and occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. And the Soviet Union does finally withdraw. Afterwards, Charlie Wilson goes to the Hill to look for $5 million for education of Afghans, and he doesn't get it. And, you know, we are good at identifying enemies and fighting them militarily. But again, this haunting point of we're not very good at creating environments afterwards, whether it is dealing with the humanitarian crisis, providing education in sufficient ways that help stabilize societies. And it's a real challenge for the United States. We have not done a great job in Afghanistan, not done a great job in Iraq. And one of the big questions after the end of the caliphate is who's going to pay for the reconstruction of these societies that were, of these cities that were all but totally destroyed by U.S. bombardment and fighting on the ground by U.S. allies. And that's going to be really tough. I was in Mosul in March, and half that city was really destroyed, and the other half was badly damaged. Raqqa, which fell just this month, right, the caliphate's capital, has been virtually destroyed. They say 80% of it is uninhabitable. And what do you do to make sure that we don't find such desperation that it gives birth to yet another version of ISIS? That's a big question.
Robin Wright is with us. If you've just joined the discussion, she is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. We spotted an article that she wrote recently about 16 years after 9/11, how does terrorism end? And we're asking her to bring the benefit of her experience and her reporting to that question and inviting you into the discussion. I've been thinking about whether you think, as listeners to this, Americans have moved beyond the never again frame of mind about terrorism, foreign terrorism on our soil, that we're more prepared and practical about it. But we're also talking about how Americans operate against terrorists in other parts of the world, too, and welcoming your questions on that. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. I have a question for you, Robin, about how the nature of terrorist communication has changed, given how terrorists have been able to use, you know, this the benefits of a networked and connected world. Has that, do you think that's influenced the goals of terrorism as they find themselves able to communicate in different ways?
Well, one of the things that's frightening and should be of great concern is that modern communications, whether it's the dark web or the open web, Twitter and social media, has made it much easier, much faster to what they call swarm or mobilize recruits for a cause. And we're now in our third generation of extremists, dating back to the early 1980s. And each generation has swarmed faster by half than the previous generation because of the quick critical question of being able to reach such a wide audience. And even if you don't get people or convince people to come join your cause, you see that it has inspired people who live in the United States, for example, to undertake acts of terrorism in the name of ISIS. So it's a real dynamic, and how to control that in a country where you have First Amendment rights is obviously a tricky one that we're still groping with.
I was reading a piece that you wrote in June after the London Bridge attacks in which you were talking to Clint Watts, a former FBI counterterrorism agent, and he told you that an organization like ISIS can draw now from a wider array of nations and that the jihadis who end up joining, and maybe this again comes back to this web of communications, the jihadis who join end up being more violent and more ambitious in their ideology. Is that connected to the way what you've just described about swarming and the way that these terrorist networks can communicate?
That's part of it, but we've also seen the evolution. The first generation of terrorists basically came out of places like Lebanon and Afghanistan in the 70s and 80s, and they were fighting what they believed to be foreign occupation, whether it was the Americans and the Israelis in Lebanon or the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. In the 90s, you saw the emergence of a second generation, groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that began to take their attacks outside of their borders. Their agendas became more regional. And then the third generation, of course, that produced the 9/11 generation. Mm-hmm. And the third generation now is more ambitious in trying to create actually states of their own to upend or oust regimes in the Middle East, but then to go on and challenge whether it's Western civilization or the outside world. With each generation, you've also seen a growth in the locations of where the recruits came from. That first generation came from largely the Gulf, some inside Lebanon, but they were locally or regionally kind of confined or concentrated. The second generation, you began to see with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, you began to see the emergence of people from outside the Gulf, from wider pockets or regions, including North Africa and in the outside world. And today, of course, the third generation, you see recruits, whether it's from, there were 2,000 Chechens alone in ISIS Some believe the numbers were much higher. That was just in one city. The Russians said close to 10,000 in total from Russia and its former territories had joined ISIS. You saw them come from Australia. There were 250 from the United States. That this third generation is truly global.
So this is interesting. I hadn't heard those numbers about Chechens and ISIS. I mean, is this an alliance that is essentially less about the core of the source, I guess, of what ISIS believes, and more about this is an ends to a means to an end to disrupt governments and create more, I don't know, lawless territory for us to operate in? How do these alliances form?
Well, I've interviewed some of those who've been captured from ISIS, and they're a very different kind of people. There are those who are ideological. There are a lot of misfits, thugs. There are those who are from rural areas and never felt represented. Some, so they're a wider variety of individuals. They do come or do emerge, and they are attracted by the idea that there is going to be a place somewhere on Earth where they can, that they will be protected, that they can live in a state that will care for them, create jobs, give them power, give them a gun, fulfill their manhood. I mean, the array of people really is staggering, and we shouldn't stereotype them because that makes it even harder to figure out how to deal with them. But it's a complicated question, but it is true that they are looking for a piece of property. Some of them are ideological and wanting to create a caliphate. But, for example, I had one of the emirs who was captured and who was had a huge piece of property under his control, 9 different cells. He dispatched suicide bombers as young as 12 and 13. Mm-hmm. And he said to me at one point, you know, whether we fail this time, there will still be a caliphate down the road, because even Jesus Christ said everyone must convert to Islam. And I pointed out that Jesus Christ lived 7 centuries before Islam was founded. And he rejected that completely. He said, no, even Abraham said that. So there's a lot of ignorance within the system. We treat the ideologues as if they're college educated and really understand their own faith. And they often don't.
Call from Mustafa in St. Paul. Hey, Mustafa, hi. Your question for Robin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi, Robin. My question is that we often talk about terrorism always do and extremists, but I want you to talk about a little bit the role of America and how they always trying to say that we promote democracy, but on the other hand, they support of the dictators and also monarchies who also abuse their people. So can you talk about a little bit the double standard of American foreign policy and how does that impact of these younger people tool of the recruitment?
Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question, actually. And needless to say, the United States is viewed by many in the Middle East as hypocritical in promoting democratic values, but not when it comes to picking our allies, whether it's Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most draconian governments in the world in terms of restrictions on women, its arrest of dissidents, failure to allow a free press or basic human rights, persecution of minorities. Yes, there is a sense that the United States would prefer stability rather than the democratic values that are at the core of our founding and our founding fathers and our government institutions. And that's a source of real antagonism with the outside world, with particularly those in the Middle East. And it played out in a way in Iraq, where we had looked for people to replace Saddam Hussein who kind of were educated in the United States or we thought could reflect American values. And one of them, a famous character named Ahmad Chalabi, was the one who provided some of the intelligence that justified our intervention in Iraq. And he claimed he would be the Pied Piper or the Spartacus of Iraq and mobilize people when he returned. And he didn't. He'd left Iraq in 1958 at the age of 18, just a teenager, and hadn't been back until our intervention in 2003. So we often look for people who look like us, speak like us, educate in the United States as alternatives, when in fact it's looking for the locals who are legitimate, embraced locally, and can get democratically elected. And that's sometimes hard for us to accept. So this is a real challenge for us, our credibility in the region.
I want to talk to you for a minute about the Muslim ban, which the latest iteration of that is tied up in a federal court again. But I was reading something that Paul Pillar, former CIA, now at Georgetown, said about the president's travel ban. He wrote, "The order, despite the title, is divorced from where actual terrorist threats to the U.S. are most likely to come from. The order does nothing to protect against the kind of attacks the U.S. has most experienced in the decade and a half since 9/11. And then he adds, "This order is anti-Islam and anti-Muslim and will be primarily read as such by audience overseas." Well, do you agree with him on that?
Yes. Yes, totally. And I think when you look at Saudi Arabia is not on the list, and 15 of the 19 9/11 perpetrators came from Saudi Arabia, that they've identified countries where people, for example, Iran. You may not like Iran or its regime, but the fact is there hasn't been a known terrorist act. There are charges that there was an attempt by a used car salesman in Texas who was reputedly hired by the Revolutionary Guards to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. But there has not been a terrorist attack by an Iranian coming into the United States. Some of the countries identified, for example, Chad, has been critical to the United States in counterterrorism operations across northern Africa and in very volatile areas. Chad borders Libya, and it's very Mali. It's very centrally located to some of the big challenges we face in that part of Africa. And it's very strange. No Chadian that I know of has engaged in a terrorist attack against the United States. So it's a peculiar list, and it does come across, particularly given the language used during the campaign, as anti-Muslim in general. And that's an very unfortunate perception.
Do you sometimes wonder where advice is coming from, you know, whether there is the kind of knowledge that would be accessible to a president, but where this advice comes from that results in three different orders like this? You know what I'm getting at. He should have the best of advice around issues like this, and sometimes it sounds like he doesn't.
Well, I'm not part of that crowd, so I don't know where he gets it.
They don't call you for, okay.
And I don't get into American politics. I spend my life doing, you know, crises overseas. But I do think it's a bad call, and to be so persistent, given both judicial decisions and the polls that indicate that this has further antagonized people in a part of the world where we need allies. I mean, the challenge for us is actually allowing systems to open up to make sure that people feel invested in their own future, that they find their own peaceful solution, and that we don't have to keep going back in militarily to deal with whether it's autocratic regimes or extremist regimes. And that's the real challenge, that the terrorism ends only when you have legitimate political solutions. And that's something that we haven't proven to be so good at.
So that was a question mark at the headline of your article for The New Yorker. And is the answer, we don't know?
Well, terrorism, I think, is going to be around for the foreseeable future. It is a tactic of warfare, and increasingly in an age where we have asymmetric war, in other words, where you're at war not with states but with some unconventional force that has very different tactics, and you're fighting different kinds of campaigns, war campaigns, with different kinds of equipment that aren't always suited to each other, that this is going to be a tactic and that we have to, you know, learn to live with it. But the challenge is not having to repeatedly spend millions of dollars every day using our air power, our drones, or our special forces to go in and kill people. The real answer is finding political solutions. And let's we can only hope that we learn that lesson.
Robin, thank you. Really interesting conversation. Robin Wright's book is called Rock the Casbah, and the article for The New Yorker, 16 years after 9/11, How Does Terrorism End? By the way, I want to mention to you, if you missed Flyover yesterday, we talked about how America is seen from abroad. I mean, it kind of dovetails with what we've been talking about this morning. You can find all of our shows at flyoverradio.org.